Welcome back. So continuing with this exploration of truthfulness, you know, in the context of the 10 paramis, these 10 perfections. Right? So if you're just kind of joining us, that seems a little intense, perfections and truthfulness. But it's basically these are the 10 attributes or capacities that the Buddha cultivated in his kind of previous lifetimes, if you will, and that led to this perfection of him being able to become the Buddha. And so we're using this as a teaching theme to explore, to kind of take each one and really kind of dive into it. And truthfulness is a really helpful one to look at, to really bring to the forefront. So this is the fifth, is it the fifth or fourth talk on this topic? And it's something that you can start to see really in your daily life, the way that you shade the truth, or maybe don't quite say things in the clearest way, or you're maybe outright lie. So tonight I want to explore truthfulness from this, how it relates to really our internal narrative, kind of this internal noise that's always going on, and how this starts to quiet down as we start to become more and more aligned with what's true. And even further, as we have some of these deeper understandings of what is actually true from a dharmic perspective, we actually go beyond words. We go beyond places where our thoughts and our ideas can really take hold on it. Now, hopefully this month you started to bring more and more awareness to this relationship to speaking what's true, what's accurate. And when you're not quite speaking it, when you're lying, you start to notice that there's a lot of internal static that's going on. There's a lot of turmoil. Maybe physically you feel it, maybe mentally you feel it. Because we may be trying to justify ourselves, to kind of rationalize why it's okay to kind of shade the truth in this way, justify why this is okay. Of course, there's also a lot of noise of trying to keep track of what we actually said. You know, what lie did I say to which person? And how can I remember that and not trip myself up? We're maybe worried about being found out. Maybe there's a sense of trying to hide some aspect of ourselves. Maybe there's a sense of shame or embarrassment. Maybe we're trying to avoid something, avoid a difficult conversation, or revealing something about ourselves, our actions, you know, our experience. While in contrast, as we start to align with what's true and speak something that's actually honest and true about ourselves, there's an accuracy with that. There's a way that things start to quiet down internally. And hopefully you've started to become more and more aware of that. There's almost this alignment that starts to come in. It's almost like things kind of become out of sync when you're lying and become lined up when we're speaking what's true. There's the martial art of Aikido. There's one particular tradition that uses this phrase, a guiding principle called weight underside. Okay, so it's one of these principles that allow their techniques to work well. And weight underside is simply, if you imagine holding up your arm, that all the weight kind of fell to the lower surfaces. So in other words, we kind of relax into ourselves. We relax into the ground, we relax into the chair or the cushion. Versus when we're speaking something which isn't true, when we're lying, notice how your weight goes to the upper surfaces. Your shoulders start to creep up and maybe there's a tension. You can feel the body language reveal that inner dissonance. We speak something that's true, there's a natural settling in. As you start to take this on more of as a practice, you start to really prefer that alignment. You prefer that sense of settling. Feel like, okay, I don't have to really remember what I said. I don't have to remember what I said or didn't say. I just have to recall what actually is true. Because we're aligned with ourselves, with what's actually happened, the actual truth of our actions. So this is one aspect of truthfulness starts to take us beyond thought, beyond ideas and words, because we're simply reporting how our experiences. This is what I did. I did take this. I did not take that. Because when we speak the truth, we don't really have to spend a lot of words explaining it. We don't have to justify or convince ourselves or someone else. Because we really have reality on our side. So truthfulness in this way starts to incline us toward an inner stillness. Now, if you're like me, many of us come to this practice with maybe, we can call it a flexible relationship to the truth. It's kind of conditional, right? It depends on who I'm talking to and what I might want to be embarrassed about or trying to hide. Or there's a, maybe there's the inner pressure. And so there's often this unpacking of this conditioning around lying or not speaking things truly in a truthful way. Because truthfulness does require a real clear and undistorted perception of how things actually are. Okay, a clear and undistorted perception of how things actually are. And for most of us, we're not very clear. We have a certain level of distortion that's built in. The Buddha would sometimes talk about dust in the eyes, how the dust obscures how we can see. Like a camera lens is dusty or distorted, not able to fully perceive how things are. That's one of the big advantages of mindfulness practice is that we're learning how to clear that lens, actually see things in a very direct, clear way. And there's also all this kind of psychological baggage, all this kind of emotional conditioning, stuff from our family of origin, from our culture, from our assumptions that we don't even realize that we have. And so part of this is you become a Dharma practitioner, or if you do any other kind of deep work, whether it's in recovery through addiction or working on some deep therapeutic or psychological work, it's often a very deep journey of inner honesty that we have to travel. We learn to become more and more honest with our own experience. I used to love, my teacher would sometimes describe our relationship to our mind is that we kind of lay everything out and see it and observe it. Because usually we hide parts. Okay, I want to maybe put that lust under the rug, or I want to hold my greed someplace else, or my envy. All those things we judge about ourselves. Mindfulness, when it's really imbued with compassion and wisdom, is about opening to this whole experience of who I am. Doesn't mean we act from it. We actually know that the more clearly we see it, the less likely are we to act unskillfully from it. So it's trying to see things how they actually are. You know, it's this journey of seeing how we've distorted it. And there's a lot of reasons why we don't tell the truth. It's not just because we're malicious or we're trying to trick someone. Sometimes we don't tell the truth because there's a lot of maybe inner shame, a little embarrassment. We don't really feel like we can fully be who we are. We want to present something different. Or maybe we're trying to avoid getting hurt. Sometimes gets really conditioned in our young years. And as we start to, okay, I want to be more truthful, I want to be aligned with it, we start to see all the storms and the internal static and fear and terror of being blamed for who we are. You know, it's this process of offloading all of this conditioning. One of my own psychological therapy work that I did, one of the powerful aspects was they had these self-care contracts that we took on, and we agreed to follow those. And the great thing about those is it's kind of like the precepts in a way. But what would happen is in my daily life, I would really watch, like one of them was not to lie. And every time I told a lie, I would basically take responsibility for that, do some psychological work around it. And the nature of that kind of group therapy is that it would actually turn out to be very deep work, because it would go to the deepest aspect of that I could. By doing that, there is a way of becoming more and more friendly with my inner experience. Got to see all the ways I would start to distort the truth based on that psychological distortions and wounding, all those things that I didn't realize that was shaping the way I showed up in the world. So that's from the psychological perspective. And from the Dharma perspective, there's often a parallel journey. They're learning how to be fully human, fully ourselves. You see someone who's practiced very deeply, there's often this hallmark that they're very natural in themselves. They just show up and how they're not trying to hide themselves or distort who they are. And for myself, as I stopped becoming working with a sense of shame and sense of inadequacy, the sense of inner lack, it was much easier to access the truth of who I was and to speak it. And in that truth, there's a simplicity. There's a sense of clarity, a sense of resonance, a sense of alignment and integrity. And we start to value that more and more as our practice deepens. You can almost think of it as a glass cup with mud in it. If we keep shaking it, that's when we keep lying. We start to speak the truth and align with that, it starts to settle. There's more and more clarity as the mud goes to the bottom and the clarity of the water comes forth. So a lot of it comes down to just, is this accurate, what I'm saying right now? Is it actually accurate? Is it actually aligned with my actions, with what I've done, with my intentions, with my thoughts, with my emotions? And we start to see, okay, is that accuracy actually being conveyed by what I speak? And we start to feel that inaccuracy, there's a dissonance with it. So it's not about being perfect or being exactly right, but it's more like, am I really owning up to what has happened in my own life? As I talked about 2 weeks ago, there's why speech isn't just about speaking what's true, but it's also understanding that whether it's beneficial and the right timing of it. Because sometimes we get into the place of maybe oversharing, sharing all these deep, dark secrets about ourselves. Sometimes you need to do that. But it's more about just having that discernment. Okay, what do I really need to say right now? What's actually true? And also, we can be in a group of people and maybe there's kind of a falsehood that's being perpetuated by the group. You know, not speaking what you know is true and accurate is also, it's not following this one parami. So we can take on this whole parami in terms of how can I speak what's true? How can I align with that? And I like to take it now into a little deeper perspective on it. Because this whole practice is learning to see through what we thought was true. There's things that we believe about ourselves that are true in the nature of ourselves, of reality. If we start to practice, we actually see that those are just maybe relatively true or they're actually completely mistaken. You know, one example is just think back when you started to practice your relationship to the thinking mind. And now how many, you know, months or years or decades you've been practicing, do you believe your thoughts as much as you used to? You know, hopefully there's more of a skepticism around what this mind thinks, because we can know how random it can be. When we're not so lost in thought, we start to open to, okay, I can actually perceive thought. We start to have that perspective. Oh, the mind just goes all over the place. So we talk about this tradition being insight meditation, insight practice, because when we see something that we thought was a certain way, we actually see how it actually is. That's often an insight. We actually realize something more aligned with how things actually are, more of the reality. More clarity. So we start to see things more how they actually are. And this often comes as a shock for us because we realize we've misunderstood the nature of things. And not only have we misunderstood it, we've kind of based our whole life upon that misunderstanding. Right? So this is a bit of a shock at times. Sometimes it's a crisis in people's practices when they realize, wow, I've seen something. I can't unsee it now. But I realize a lot of the assumptions of my life were based on something that wasn't actually true. There was a distortion. You know, you can see it from a psychological perspective. We can see it from a Dharma perspective. And our whole life is, we realize there's something has to really shift in a fundamental way. We also start to get a sense of how much of our thinking is based upon trying to maintain that illusion. Like we're rationalizing or, you know, trying to justify a lie, for example. Even just that internal narrative that you sit quietly. And how many of us did we have that internal narrative? How am I doing as a meditator right now? What did I forget to do today? You know, what's that internal self-defining quality? Because this, when we're not seeing things how they actually are, there's actually an inherent instability to that. There's something that's not quite stable because we're having to put energy into it to keep it going. We have to keep shoveling coal into that to keep that engine going. And that's why sometimes the Buddha talked about this practice, realization of this practice, the liberation is nibbana, this cooling down, this quenching of the fires, slowing down of these fires of greed, of hatred, and delusion. There's these four misperceptions that we start to see through as our practice matures and deepens. One is mistaking the ethereal for the enduring. Mistaking something which is inherently impermanent as something as permanent. There's also mistaking sorrow and pain for satisfaction. Mistaking the non-self, what is non-self, as self. And mistaking which is really unauspicious for the beautiful. So these four we start to see through more and more clearly. So this is aligning with what's actually true. And this is where we start to have a moment of truth in our practice. We kind of have to fish or cut bait in some ways. Because our practice, we start to realize that our practice itself sometimes has these misconceptions built into it. We start to realize, okay, the very reason and assumptions I started the practice don't make sense anymore. Because perhaps you started a practice and you thought, okay, this sounds really good. I want to be like the Buddha. I want to be, you know, really a much better version of myself. You know, that's happy and peaceful and equanimous and, you know, just much better, right? An uber me. But we start to realize that the practice is more of a reduction. It's more of a subtraction. It's actually letting go of all these things we've added to who we take ourselves to be. To actually understand this essence, which is actually here all along. That we didn't have to actually go anywhere. We didn't have to attain anything. We just had to clear our distortions, to see in a clear way. And sometimes there's a tension, like, okay, I'd rather kind of be in this familiar misperception and still practice. And I think it's better to practice from that misperception than not practice at all, for sure. Absolutely. Because it helps us be more functional, have more clarity, less reactive. We get to know ourselves more clearly. And sometimes the practice, no matter what our intentions are, starts to show us the truth of things. So let's explore that a little bit. Because there's just a simple, benign practice of mindfulness. I'm about to teach an intro series. It's a six-week series, and most people come on that haven't really meditated or meditated with apps, don't have a lot of experience with meditation. But you know, that being said, people come who have a lot more experience. So if you feel like you want to have some refresher on the basics or haven't gone through intro class, consider doing that. But sometimes I feel like I need to give a little disclaimer about this simple practice of mindfulness, because it seems like it's really good for everything, right? You just practice mindfulness and you just become more relaxed and more calm. But actually, what mindfulness is designed to do is start to show us those things we've mistakenly believe is true. It does it kind of in a sneaky way by just saying, just sit down and relax and feel your breath. And don't try to change your breath. Don't try to make it longer or shorter. Try to have a non-judgmental relationship to the breath. Let the breath be just how it is. That sounds pretty benign, doesn't it? Right? And then we say, okay, well, you kind of learned that with the breath. Now go into something like body sensations. Do the same thing. Just allow the body sensations to come and go. Well, let's do the same thing with emotions and thoughts. And we've kind of learned this very simple technique. But as we do that, it's actually working behind the scenes to kind of erode the belief, because it's actually showing us how things actually are instead of how we take them to be. It starts to access a deeper level of truth. We can look at these three characteristics of dukkha, of impermanence, and non-self as a way of kind of understanding how that truth starts to be revealed, which are really those misperceptions. So learning to rest your attention on the breath without our normal habits of judgment, of evaluation, control. You're learning to just perceive it how it actually is and to relax the part of us that don't allow it to be how it actually is. This starts to teach us this truth or this characteristic of impermanence. We start to see that the breath is actually not one thing. Like if I asked you each to describe the breath, describe your breath, you know, what would you come up to say? You know, maybe you pull out one little microsecond of the breath. But does that microsecond really represent this fluid movement of air going into the body and going out of the body? And anytime anything we pick to describe, the breath has already moved on to a new thing. It's already moved on to a new experience. And this really starts to teach us this relationship to change, to the dynamic nature of really all things, the things are coming and going. And our minds like to kind of fix it, to make it solid, right? This is the breath. My breath is deep. My breath is shallow. We start to look at the reality of it. We see it's actually a very rich, always changing, always fluxing experience. Now, if you take that and start to extrapolate that to other experiences, then the ride gets a little bit more exciting, doesn't it? Because we look at our bodies, for example. Okay, I know my body. You know, I like parts of it. I don't like other parts of it. It's weak here, strong there, injuries here, scars here, tattoos here, whatever it might be, this age. As I start to close my eyes and open to the felt sense of that, where do all those thoughts go? Do those thoughts actually have a place to land when we're actually going to the direct experience of the body? And when we do that, we realize what I took as being me is actually just the thoughts about me. And this direct experience of the body coming and going is much more rich. So we start to see, okay, this is how dukkha shows up, that quality of suffering, is that we take something that is inherently fluid and moving and try to make it static. We try to lock it into place. And in that very locking, we create suffering. Because have you found anything that you can fix and so it never changes? Has anyone been able to never age or get sick? Anyone ever figure out how never to have any relationships end? Pleasure just continues forever. This is where the dukkha comes in. So you can see this very simple practice of mindfulness, opening to the body, breathing, the body sensing, the arising of the mind and the body, starts to teach us these two aspects of impermanence and how suffering comes from me as trying to make something solid, trying to make something that's fluid into a solidity, trying to change something that's a verb into a noun. A side note is that Pali, the language as close as we can get to the time of the Buddha, is actually a language of verbs. English is a language of nouns. So we tend to hear the teachings from that bias of nouns. Okay, this is what this is. This is what dukkha is. This is what impermanence is. But if it's a language of verbs, it's actually something that's very fluid, that's always coming and going. So you start to become curious, well, why do I do this? Why do I try to fix things? Why do I try to make things solid? You know, and it's, of course, not just the people in this room, online or in person. I mean, there's whole industries in our culture based on trying to push back the clock, trying to make ourselves youthful to avoid this reality of aging. And this actually leads into this final characteristic of non-self, that the sense of separate me-ness of you-ness is actually one of those illusions. That's one of the things we start to see through. And the simple benign practice, seemingly benign practice of meditation, is that we learn to, okay, allow the breath to be how it is, allow the sensation to be how it is. Relaxing the capacity or the tendency to judge it, to alter it, to change it. This isn't actually just about decreasing our reactivity and increasing our equanimity. Those are beautiful aspects. But it's actually some of the main ways the sense of self establishes itself is through that judging and controlling and fixing. If you've sat a retreat with Philip Moffitt, or often Tweri Salam, my fellow guiding teacher, she often likes to bring his three renouncings into the beginning of the retreat. Renouncing comparing, renouncing fixing, and judging. Comparing, judging, and fixing to renounce those patterns. So imagine you're starting a silent retreat. These patterns are kind of baked into the way you perceive. I mean, how many times did you come into the hall here doing some kind of comparison? It's like, oh, I'm sitting better than that person. I'm sitting worse than that person. I need to fix this part of my mind. I need to get rid of this tendency. I need to fix that sound that keeps rattling. Judging, okay, I'm better than that. So this is a very helpful thing because to take on because it starts to quiet us down. But it's also a gateway into a deeper truth. Because who are you if you're not comparing? Who are you if you're not comparing yourself to anyone else? Who are you if you're not judging yourself or others? Who are you if you're not trying to fix your environment or fix your internal environment? If you start to really take that in, you realize you don't quite know who you are. Because so much of that sense of you is based upon those strategies. So mindfulness practice helps us to start to release those strategies. What it often doesn't tell us is that it's releasing this much deeper aspect of who we are, who we take ourselves to be. That's the, sometimes I feel like I should make a disclaimer, is that kind of like a warning that if you really practice this, you might become less sure of who you are. That's both good news and bad news. Okay, from the ego's perspective, it's really bad news because our whole life has been based upon those assumptions. I'm really good at judging. I'm really good at fixing. I'm really good at comparing. But if I'm not doing those, who and what am I? The good news is that that's actually pointing toward and revealing a much deeper essence of who you actually are. This starts to begin to interesting territory because our minds can't really speak to that. We can't really put words to it. There's a poem, a short section of a poem that I read so many times, but I never get tired of it. From Rumi, that out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. So Rumi is pointing toward how we have these ideas of right doing and wrong doing. He's not saying throw out ethics and non-harm. It's about how these ideas of comparing and judging create a certain separation. So there's a field that I'll meet you there. And when the soul lies down in that grass, when the essence of you lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So you get a sense of that. This is an opening to a much deeper truth beyond this normal perception of separation of self and other. When we actually let go of the verbiage, when we let go of the words in a very deep way, we allow ourselves to lie down to that grass in that field. The world is too full to talk about. It's not like it disappears. If we release our thoughts about it, it actually becomes so full that our minds can't place a word on it. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So this deeper level of truth starts to just reveal itself. based on our simple practice. That's why sometimes when you're meditating and you're thinking, okay, I'm feeling really connected and steady and deep, there's a little bit of an existential disease that comes, or sometimes some fear, some trepidation, because I don't know who I am in this moment. If I'm not thinking about myself, if I'm not redefining myself, what am I? Okay, that's the mind and the ego kind of freaking out in a moment. And yet there's still something that's aware, something that's present. And that's what Rumi is hinting at. There's this truth of who we actually are outside of this ego, this mind, this sense of self. And this is where some of the awakened masters speak so beautifully toward it. Another favorite one is from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who's an Indian saint, actually lived in this last century. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life flows. Right? So this deep looking inside and seeing that there's an inherent emptiness or inherent nothingness. Not in kind of a voidness, but just there's not that sense of self that seems so strong. When I look deeply, I actually can't find that. And yet when I look outward, I see not separation, but I see connection. I see unity. And that is the expression of love. And between these two, life flows. And then from Zen, from the patron saint of Zen, Dzogchen, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So these three awakened masters talking, describing this perspective, this way of perceiving, speaking from this truth of our essence, of who we are. So in these deeper aspects of truth, you know, words start to fail us. They start to fall away. We start to see things how they actually are. And there's a liberation in that scene. And we see that early on in our practice and all the way through our practice, a moment of clear seeing when we realize, okay, I was relating to life in a way that was a little distorted, that wasn't quite the way it was, or maybe radically not the way it actually is. There's a liberation that comes from that seeing. Because there's a truth that when we see things how they actually are, it transforms us. It starts to change the way we perceive. Goes beyond our thoughts, beyond our ideas and concepts, behind things we could have imagined. And yet there's this resonance of this truth. And this is what the Dharma practice is most deeply about, is trying to, for all each one of us, is to see this. And the Buddha said, you know, I wouldn't ask you to do it if it wasn't possible. You know, there's this beautiful roadmap, multiple roadmaps that he developed and laid out that we practice to this day. And starting with a simple practice of mindfulness, just letting yourself see what is actually the truth of this. What am I believing is true that may not be? And then allow it to emerge, allow it to be revealed. All right, if we could just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle, and then we'll open to some questions. All right, so unless the world is too full to talk about, if you have any questions about truthfulness, about your practice, be glad to explore them with you. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand and we'll call on you and we can hear you here in the room. In person, if you could raise your physical hand, we can give you a mic so they can hear you online.
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate your words and talk today, especially about truth and the role it plays in meditation, and that how meditation helps with that. Also really appreciate your remark about the weight underside from Aikido.
Yes.
Just today I was walking and thought about all the times that I get worked up. And your remark about kind of like shoulders and the opposite of weight underside. I happen to have done a little bit of Aikido, so I kind of, that meant something to me as well. But it seemed very helpful for recognizing early on what's going on with my body and what my thinking is to catch myself.
Yes.
When things are not going the way I would like them to go. Have a small question about the word fix when you said, talked about three things. Is it fix in the sense of keeping unchanged or fix as in repair? I think the three things that you were describing were...
Right, there. Yeah, from Philip Moffitt, is to renounce comparing, judging, and fixing. Yeah, so fixing, I think his intention was more how the mind's like, okay, I'm going to make this a little bit better. Like, I'm going to adjust this way and make these things. But you can also look at it from that, I think that's a deeper way of looking at how we fix it and make things solid and unchanging. Like, you will always be the same way, you're never going to change, I'm never going to change. That's a way of fixing. You can feel that, how there's that solidity. But I think his thing was more of that, kind of,
broader.
Being the master mechanic and tweaker and kind of fussing with things.
One last question. A little bit more tricky for me. I feel like it's hard to see how I can, like if I follow the idea of being a bit more detached, a bit more kind of distancing myself from my idea of self, my emotions, the world. I feel like if I go more in that direction, I might become indifferent to the world and want to just not, I might not care about anything in the world. Probably that's not how it's supposed to work. So maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's such an important point, because when we hear the teaching, sometimes it does seem like we're supposed to kind of disconnect, you know, be distant from life, kind of, you know, not be to be caught in our craving or aversion, to be lost in greed or hatred. So that, what does that mean? What am I left with if I'm not doing those things? And it is kind of a common misunderstanding or misinterpretation, because basically we're kind of thinking, okay, this is the sense of self that is not affected by things, so I'm going to try to fake it till I make it, kind of a thing. And so can that quality, I think it's much more helpful is to go more the route of interconnection, of deep opening, deep intimacy to this moment. Okay, what is this moment? And we have to, you know, temper it with discernment when this moment is too much to open to, or if the situation I need to take a break, or, you know, for safety, whatever those things are. But if, you know, just kind of the run-of-the-mill moment, can I fully show up? So let's make it a little bit more real for a second. So let's say I want to assume the wise teacher persona. So I'm going to kind of sit back and be, well, that's an interesting question. Let me speak to, you know, I can talk from a place of distance, or I can kind of let go of any kind of forming around the role of this dynamic and just okay, let's explore, let's connect with this in a very real way. And so as I'm doing that, I'm also really fully connected to my inner experience. You know, there's a kind of a, it's not like I'm being like in a retreat where I'm like, okay, I'm going to reach down and touch this cup and, you know, kind of letting go of everything else. It's much more of a light awareness, but noticing that sense of alignment, that sense of integrity, that sense of expression, kind of allow that to flow through clearly. If I said something that wasn't quite true, like that's, do you like that yellow chair there? You know, I can feel the contraction in my heart from telling something which isn't true. It's actually a forest green, and then there's that alignment that comes in. And so think of it more that way. It's like, I'm going to open fully into life, and in that opening, try to allow that fluidity to come in. Because when we start to become a little bit more removed or aloof or disconnected, there's that fixing. You know, there's like we're that solidifying thing that's starting to happen. Because I have to solidify myself to be there. It's much more like you're trying to flow into the river, let the river flow and letting yourself flow along with it.
So maybe like what's occurring to me is not so much, you know, get rid of all these attachments, but rather to be aware of them and more mindful of when some of them are stronger than I want them to be.
That's right.
And yeah.
Yeah, so exactly, because that's the other side of it, is that we have this idea of equanimity, for example. We kind of put all these things which aren't equanimous and we kind of put them under the rug. Instead, okay, let me explore them. Let me open to what that feels like to want something, to feel that attachment. Without judging it, without trying to change it, but just open to it in a really full, complete way. Trust that the seeing of it clearly is what's going to transform you. And that starts to allow you to see in a more and more clear way. It starts to fall away, not because you decided to let go of it, but because you've seen it clearly enough.
And it's not like, I mean, like speaking to myself now a little bit out loud, it's not like everything is, you know, not attached. It's actually that everything is attached and everything is connected somehow.
That's right.
And not one thing more than the others.
That's right.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You so much.
All right, anyone else? Yes, Cheryl right in the front.
Hi, thanks for the talk. You said something, practicing from a familiar misperception, that I was like, oh yeah, that really feels like what I'm doing a lot of the time. And I think there's sort of the like touching into moments of deep truth on retreat or whatever, mm-hmm. and then not being able to dwell there. And I think, I guess the question is, like, when you're sort of aware that there's that difference there, how do you think about relating to that? Because there's the, I have like the really striving to stay there, which doesn't work. And then I have the kind of like going too far into the misperception. And I find it really difficult to let that difference be there. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, yeah. That's a very common experience. So we have these deeper states that we have access to on retreat because we have nothing to do but practice. And so that cultivates a clearer seeing. And sometimes, oh, wow, I see things in a different way. And there's also a state that goes with that. Maybe you feel more peaceful or more open-hearted or joyous or whatever it might be. We come back in our life, it's like, where did that state go? How can I get back to it? And, you know, as you've known from your own practice, trying to get back to it doesn't really work so well, right? It's like, yeah. That's part of that clinging that comes up. And but yet we get frustrated because in our lives we just see there's so much misconception or misperception that's causing suffering, but we know that there's something different. Right? Does that kind of sum up the question?
Yeah, I think so.
So the way to reframe it is times on retreat or just times in our practice when we have access to clarity. It might be just a life event that we see something really clearly. Something falls away. Focus more on how we perceive from that, how that perspective, there's something we see different that feels really true in that moment. And then when we're in the middle of life and we feel like, okay, I have no access to that truth, trying to argue with the fact that there's, you can't find that truth, but realize, oh, I don't believe in this quite the same way. This misperception isn't believed in the same way. Because you saw something different on the retreat. Mm. Okay, so then you start to work with it in a different way. Instead of it being a problem, actually look at it as kind of a, like someone gave you a customized spiritual practice called your life. Like, this is the things that you need to start to see and integrate in your life. And so what you can do, play with it, is kind of, okay, what am I believing is true right now? Kind of, honestly, what do I believe is true? And it's actually stating it and almost externalizing it so you can see it more clearly. You can see how that contrasts with what you saw in the retreat. Because there's something very different in that. Okay, so how am I misperceiving that? Again, it's tricky because if you're a little too heavy-handed, I'm looking at this in order to get rid of it, mm-hmm. it just kind of tightens up. But if you have this really sincerity of just, let me really understand it. I really want to understand the shape of my suffering. I want to understand the shape of my misperceptions. Does that kind of make sense? So part of it is really is working with the very natural aversion and judgment toward those misperceptions. To actually start to meet them with love and understanding and curiosity. And trust that that will start to transform the pattern.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think the misperception, it does affect the practice. Like, there's a lack of, like, wholeheartedness there or something mm-hmm. like that. And so it's, yeah, I guess bringing that wholeheartedness to the misperception itself makes sense.
That's right, because you don't have the retreat to give you the energy. You don't have people sitting around you and practicing night, you know, morning to night. What you substitute for that is the interest and energy to look more clearly.
Okay, thank you.
And there's things you can see more clearly in daily life that you can't see on retreat.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks.
All right, we got a couple people online. Carla, if you'd like to go ahead. Let's see, maybe you don't have permission to unmute. Let me see if I can give that to you. Okay, now you should be more successful.
Yes, there we go. Thank you. I have a question more around the ethical precept of telling the truth. I've heard other Buddhist teachers talk about it and say that even omitting part of the truth could be considered lying from the perspective of our precepts. And I wonder what your take on that is. I'm specifically thinking about, I have people in my life that when I share the entire truth, it doesn't go very well. And I don't mean just that I'm sharing, you know, my judgments of them. Even some, like, they'll just ask me, how are you doing? Like, my parents will just be, how are you? And, you know, life being as it is, 90% of the time, life is a mixture of things going really well and there being some struggles, and that's just normal life. And I, you know, with a close friend, I would say, oh yeah, all of this is going great. And then I've had this thing come up that I'm struggling with, and then they're there for me. I notice with my parents, if I talk about having any kind of vulnerability, they do not like to hear about that. It makes them, you know, angry, defensive, they deflect, or, you know, all kinds of things. I can see by their reactions that they're not really open to taking in the fact that I'm a human being who also has struggles. So I wonder, in those situations, when I consider that part of, you know, right speech is also, is it timely, is it kind, is it helpful for them, how to walk that line. If I am, you know, I find myself often really telling them so little about my life, just something very superficial that really does not truthfully reflect how I'm experiencing my life. But my experience has been if I share more of the full truth, we can't really connect about it.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds painful that arises, because you want to share yourself more fully. And you remember, you know, the beneficial part is for them to hear it, is beneficial for you to say it too. There's also that discernment. I mean, and it's tricky too, because there's a dynamic set up, you know, these are people that you've known the longest in your whole life, right? There's this lot of history. This is heavy history, heavy conditioning that comes up both from them and from you. And, you know, you look at system studies, you know, if one person changes in a system, the rest of the system wants to kind of push that person back to fit into the system, because otherwise the whole system has to change. And that's a dynamic that we do struggle with, you know, as practitioners, and, you know, it just as we become more and more honest with ourselves, it becomes more important. And yet the system sometimes doesn't want that honesty. And so what I often do is I kind of do a little test. Like maybe I might, you know, say, oh yeah, there's some hard stuff, but, you know, overall good. And just see if they ask about the hard stuff, if they actually demonstrate the sincerity and willingness to listen. Just like with a complete stranger, you won't necessarily just unload your deepest, you know, you're having the worst day of your life, you don't want to necessarily unload that upon a grocery clerk, for example. But sometimes they're more attentive than you realize. So it's kind of like another way to describe. So part of it is sometimes we try to fit Dharma practice, and there's a better fit, other systems or other techniques are a better fit. But I almost think of it as here's two people coming together in a meeting, right? So there's a meeting in honesty and sincerity and connection. But if you're here and the other person's like going all over the place, instead of trying to chase them down and let me tell you the truth of my experience, that doesn't work so well. So it's almost like you say, okay, it's almost having more boundaries. Okay, here I am. And if they meet you, then there's a dialogue that can happen. But part of it is that the difficulty of your parents may not have as much depth or willingness to open or capacity to open as you would like or you would need or want in this moment. So part of it is, you know, trying to use the teachings as a way to kind of force, you know, shoehorn a situation into it, but realize, okay, this is guidance. I have to also be beneficial for myself and for them. And maybe it's not very beneficial for you to share that. And at the same time, give a little bit of a test and see, because they might surprise you actually at times. There might be times when they actually are much more aware. And it sounds like they just care a lot about you. They really care about how you're doing, and they have trouble holding the fact that you may struggle and not realize, oh, that you're actually a mature grown-up that actually can navigate the world. Yeah, thanks for asking that. That's
Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything? Yes, Beth.
This was a really provocative talk tonight. Thank you, Tim. And I really launched into the idea of seeing things clearly, and it made me remember something. This is a share that experience I had with a Dharma buddy I did some study with years ago. And we used, so at one point we got this Thich Nhat Hanh saying, are you sure? ? And he said in one of the teachings I listened to, he said to put it like up somewhere in your house. And just sort of like you said, seeing things clearly, are you sure? And my friend and I decided to send each other random texts asking that question just during the day. Mm-hmm. And we did it regularly for a while. And then as with everything, it's subsided. But every now and then, I get this random text during the day, just during the day. And be, are you sure? I'm like, oh, am I? So, you know, just that's it.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that's, I love those kind of practices, especially with a partner or a friend. It kind of brings more energy. It's like, okay, how can I keep this investigation of what is actually true? Like 2 weeks ago, I talked about Byron Katie's work. You know, is this true? Do you really know that it's true? You know, because you know it's absolutely true. Who would you be if that doesn't exist? I mean, so she developed this work to kind of take something like that. And so like Thich Nhat Hanh had a similar, you know, do you know, for sure? And when we can become more and more honest with that, I mean, I become less and less sure. I mean, if you look at when I started practice, I was a lot more sure of how things should be. And now I'm like, well, you know, there's the momentarily arising of connection, but there's also just the awareness of how many different diversity there is in this room and in our practice. All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything?
Thanks, Tim. You mentioned aligning a couple times in the talk. Can you speak more about that and what are you aligning?
Sure. Yeah, I was kind of using that, you know, I, like the gentleman here, I practiced Aikido for many years, so there's kind of that sense of knowing when things are lined up and when they're not lined up. And you got this kind of physical feedback all the time. If you're doing something, you're not lined up, you know, things collapse, the structure collapses. When it's aligned, it feels like someone's pressing into the earth, and there's like, you're like not even there. There's this kind of clear line. And so you can experiment when you're saying something which isn't true, pay attention to what the body's doing, you know, because the body's, you know, is going to try to do something to kind of not be fully there. And that sometimes is because we're saying something that's a direct lie, or sometimes we're saying something that we're not quite able to own or don't want to own fully, or there's a sense of embarrassment, or maybe there's a discernment that maybe this isn't a helpful thing to really share. And also times when you're able to just, okay, I'm going to share things in a clear way, in a direct way, in an accurate way, there's a way the body just feels like it's hooked up, it's lined up. It's like gravity is flowing through it. I don't have to flinch by saying something which is true. You know, of course, there's all the work that we have to do to be able to access that and kind of work through our conditioning and all those things. But there's just kind of notice how you can say things in a clear way. Notice like if you talk to a grocery clerk, I think those are great people to practice with, because there's kind of this customary, how are you doing, fine, kind of a thing. But sometimes if you really show up and ask, well, how are you doing? And they can tell that you're really listening. Sometimes they tell you a lot of stuff, that they're having a hard day. And just that can craving that moment of connection. So part of it is that, for me, when I say alignment, there's alignment inward, there's also the connection with another person or the situation. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, maybe time for one or two more, depending on what comes up, if there's anyone.
Thanks for the talk, Tim. Somewhere in the middle, you talked about four distortions.
Yes.
And you said them once, and I can remember one of them. I was really intrigued by that, and I wondered if you could either repeat them or
sure.
Tell me like the title of what those are.
So. Yeah, I found this in a old book I have, but no, Tuori's talked about it. So the book I had called them the Four Misapprehensions, which is kind of an interesting translation, maybe four misperceptions. But they're basically the four, mistaking the ethereal for the enduring. So we're mistaking something which is permanent, impermanent, as being permanent, right? So there's that mistaken belief. Basically, it's mapping over the three characteristics. Mistaking sorrow for satisfaction, so mistaking pain for pleasure. there's mistaking what's non-self as being self. And then the last one is mistaking, this translation was what's unauspicious for the beautiful, for mistaking what's ugly for what's beautiful, right? So it's this misperception of how things actually are. So part of that is our conditioning, our delusion, all those things come together so we don't see things so clearly. Dharma practice is about actually seeing things how they actually are.
Do you have any insights on why they included the fourth one, the
Sutta? Yeah, inauspicious for the beautiful or the ugly for the beautiful. This one is more pointing, my guess just off the top of my head, it's more pointing toward like the four foundations of mindfulness. There's this one part of the sutta where he's talking about the kind of the loathsomeness of the body, and he'd go through like the pus and the, you know, all these different aspects of the body. And part of that, I think, is to kind of break the kind of attachment to the body. Say, okay, I'm so, my body, you know, making myself beautiful and all those things, is just to see that inherently this is going to decay. We have to be careful with that one too, because it's easily resonates with our, you know, this kind of almost epidemic low self-esteem in our culture. And even in the Buddha's time, there's this one sutta where he teaches something about, you know, focus on the foulness of the body. And he comes back, you know, a few months later, and there's a lot less practitioners there. And he asked, what's going on? He said, well, people practiced and they actually became suicidal by practicing this way. And that's why there's less of them here. So I don't know if he really realized that, or the sutta didn't really highlight that, but we have to be careful with some of those things. When it starts to resonate, like, you know, if we have trouble connecting and we want to be disconnected through equanimity, that's, it's kind of lining up in a not a healthy way with our, you know, if we start to, okay, I have new ways to judge myself, that's not so helpful. But I think it's more about just kind of being less attached to this body. Doesn't mean we're not caring for it, we're not connecting for it, we're not taking care of it the best way we can. It's just more that sense of identity that happens when, the first gray hair I get, then I'm going to be really devastated. It's more of that, okay, this is part of the nature of life. Yeah, so it's one of those teachings we have to be gentle with. Anyone else? Okay, well, thank you for your engagement and exploration. It's such an important topic, not only for yourself personally, but also for all the people that you connect with, that know you in your life. The more of a relationship you have with what's true, and truthfulness, that benefits all beings, you know, and having the discernment and the beneficial timing, all those aspects. So next week on, I think it's the 1st, is that right? Tori will be back here teaching, I believe, and then we'll have our forgiveness. One thing I forgot to mention is the 16th is going to be an annual forgiveness ceremony, so we'll offer some talks around forgiveness, and Tori and myself and also Carrie will be here, and then we'll also do a little ceremony. All right, I hope to see you next time. I'll be back in later September, and have a lovely evening. Thank you.